From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and we begin this hour with an all-nighter. House and Senate negotiators spent last night and this morning ironing out the details of a historic reshaping of the financial system. The goal? To make sure the meltdown of 2008 never happens again. Final approval of the bill is expected in the Senate and House next week. NPR's John Yitzdi reports now on what's in the bill and on the final hours of the horse trading that produced it.
It was a bleary-eyed group of lawmakers who heard the clerk read the vote count to Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd just before 6 a.m. this morning.
Mr. Chairman, the votes are 7 aye, 5 nay. The bill is passed.
I thank my colleagues immensely.
The vote came as a great relief for Democrats. There had been tense disagreements within the party over whether federally insured banks should be allowed to continue trading derivatives and investing in hedge funds. At one point, Northeastern Democrats threatened to bolt. In the end, a compromise emerged that sharply restricts bank involvement with derivatives and hedge funds. Later in the morning at the White House, President Obama touted another big element of the reform, the creation of a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Through this agency, we'll combine under one roof the consumer protection functions that currently are divided among half a dozen different agencies. Now there will be one agency whose sole job will be to look out for you.
Consumer advocates like Ed Merzwinski of U.S. PIRG were ecstatic about the new Consumer Bureau.
Without a doubt, it's a landmark reform.
Merzwinski says it will be able to protect consumers in their dealings with banks and almost everywhere else they get their financial products.
Everything from mortgage companies to payday lenders. The only exception that's of any size is that the new bureau does not have authority over car loans.
The politically powerful auto dealers fought hard for that exemption, but they didn't escape altogether. The bill subjects auto dealers to tougher oversight by the Federal Trade Commission. Wall Street didn't do as well trying to avoid restrictions. Banks will be less free to take on certain kinds of risk, and they'll have to hold more capital as a cushion against losses. Ultimately, that means less profit, says Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable.
We're concerned about the ability of banks to continue to lend. We're concerned about the U.S.'s competitiveness in a global marketplace.
But Talbot says this morning's vote on the largest overhaul of financial regulation since the Great Depression does remove some uncertainty from the markets, which is a good thing. He says he has no doubt the bill will pass next week in the House and Senate. The bill also creates a new Financial Stability Council to try to anticipate financial crises. The council will have the power to seize and break up large failing financial firms. The cost of winding down failing firms would be borne by shareholders, creditors, and the banking industry, not taxpayers. But despite the cries of never again from members of Congress after the near collapse of the financial system 18 months ago, there will be future financial crises. That's the view of Doug Elliott, a former investment banker, who's now a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The bill will not prevent financial crises. You can't do that, unfortunately. The financial system's run by humans, and we make mistakes, both individually and collectively. What it will do, though, is it will significantly decrease the frequency and the pain from those financial crises.
Democratic negotiators will probably go to bed early tonight, smiling with satisfaction. After all, they've handed President Obama most of what he asked them for a year ago. They've also provided evidence of U.S. progress on financial reform that the president can tout at the G20 summit in Toronto this weekend. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Let's say you're hosting the G8 and G20 summits over the next few days. Let's say that you set out to spend as much money as you possibly could doing that, on facilities, on security, on keeping the delegations and the media well-fed and well-lubricated. Throw in a pavilion promoting local tourist attractions, say. Well, the Canadians are hosting this time, starting with the group of 8 today and the group of 20 tomorrow, and they are out of the gate spending. Some comparisons here. Last April, London spent $30 million on the G20 summit. A couple of years ago, Tokyo vastly surpassed that total, spending $381 million on security alone. So how much are the Canadians spending on the G20 in Toronto and the G8 that precedes it in suburban Huntsville? Well, here with the answer is reporter Derek Stoffel of the CBC. How much?
Robert, $1 billion, if you can believe. That's what the price tag is for security. You know, what that buys you is a huge fence. I'm standing right in front of it in downtown Toronto, about 12 and a half feet tall. It's made of concrete. There's lots of metal. You can't climb up the top of it. And then behind it, about 10,000 cops from across Canada are here. So that's what $1 billion buys you if you want to host the G20 and the G8 in Toronto.
But $1 billion, I mean, this is equivalent to what Canada spent on the Winter Olympics, which went on considerably longer and had a lot more athletes than there are summit delegations to a G20 conference.
I think that's why so many Canadians are scratching their heads and saying, why are they spending so much money here? And then just give me some quick background here. The original summit, the G8, was supposed to be up in cottage country, and that was, you know, a much smaller meeting, smaller price tag. But then as soon as they made it the G20, all these leaders coming, and they decided to throw it right in downtown Toronto, the biggest city in the country. And that meant securing this huge area. So that's when things started getting expensive. But there's also some things that are kind of questionable. And I think at the top of that list there is, Robert, the fake lake.
The embarrassing point about the fake lake is that people are reduced to saying, well, it only costs $57,000. But, of course, the question is, why is there a fake lake in Toronto?
Yeah, and that's the big question. And the government, the line from the Canadian government is that all this spending is promoting Canada, that maybe people from the States, they're seeing the summit, maybe they'll come up and have a visit. And that just didn't happen at previous G8 summits. And the best example is when Canada held this the last time in 2002 out in the Rocky Mountains in Alberta. They said, yeah, all kinds of people are going to come out and visit Canada. And the tourist officials that we've talked to say, well, that didn't really happen. Maybe only a 5% bump. So a lot of Canadians are really angry about this $1 billion price tag.
Yes, you said that the main object that is created for all this is a fence around Toronto. But there have been security at all of the recent big conferences. $1 billion seems an awful lot to build a security barrier in a city.
Yeah, and you know the government's line is that it's better to be safe than sorry. You have to protect all these dignitaries. Canada's National Police Force, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they're here in huge numbers, and a lot of the money is being spent on putting them up in Toronto hotels. So, Robert, that's how a lot of the money is being spent, and officials are having some tough times trying to justify that expenditure.
Well, Derek Stoffel, thank you very much for talking with us about the G20, G8 conferences in Canada.
You're welcome.
Derek Stoffel, a reporter for the CBC.
Now a mystery, a global economic mystery, involving tomatoes. Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg explains.
It was a Jamaican businessman, a guy named Joe Madelon, who first told me about the tomato mystery. We were at his house in Kingston having a wide-ranging discussion about the Jamaican economy when he said this.
You go to a supermarket today and you buy a tomato, and they sell local tomatoes at a much higher price than they sell imported tomatoes in a supermarket. Labeled imported tomato, Jamaican tomato, and the Jamaican tomato is more expensive. We import most of the food that we eat, and we live in a tropical country. It gets here less expensive than the product that was grown in the fields of St. Elizabeth.
Which is how far away?
2.5 hours.
Well, I like a good mystery as much as the next guy, so I set off for St. Elizabeth, agricultural parish in western Jamaica, to try and figure it out. The answer came when I met a farmer named Winchell Wellington, nicknamed Gabby. The nickname comes from a cartoon character that was on Jamaican television when he was a boy. Gabby has a small 3-acre farm in St. Elizabeth, but he only works there a couple months out of the year. The rest of the time, he works somewhere else.
I work on a farm in America.
You worked on a farm in America? Where?
Lake City up in Florida.
I ask Gabby, what's the difference between farming in America and farming here? And he gets this overwhelmed look in his eye, as if I'd asked, what's the difference between building a sandcastle and a skyscraper? Take melons. In America, he says,
they plant 25 acres of melon in one day.
Uh-huh. 25 acres in one day?
Yeah. They got a tractor, we do 20 acres for the day.
And how much can you plant here?
It take a lot of man to do 25 acres. Maybe it take 15, 25 people to do that.
Right.
And in America, where I work, they do 25 acres with three of us.
So 25 acres with just three people in America versus 25 acres with 10, 15, or 25 people in Jamaica. And that's just to plant the crops. Let's not even get into spraying.
We spray 150 acres from 1:30 and by 6, you finish.
Right. And here it would take how long to spray?
150 acres would take you maybe 3-4 days with maybe 4, 5, 6 pump. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to compete with them.
Gabby had lots of stories like this, a litany of amazing things they did in America. Better machines, better seeds, better sprays. And all of these things combined, of course, are the solution to our tomato mystery. It's this massive technological advantage that makes tomatoes from abroad so much cheaper. But as often happens, solving one mystery just leads to another. Why doesn't Gabby just buy the same technology, the same seeds and fertilizer and irrigation systems that they have in America? Maybe then he could become more competitive.
Typically, it is the lack of ability to get loans from the banking system.
This is Rosemary Garcia with the economic consulting firm Nathan Associates. She says you see farmers like Gabby a lot in the developing world. They know exactly what they need to buy to be more productive, but they can't get the money, often for a pretty simple reason.
They may not have titles to their lands. If they don't have the right paperwork, then therefore they can't provide their land as collateral, and therefore the banks are not willing to take that risk.
Garcia says this leads to the situation you have in Jamaica, where there are two types of farms: large-scale, technologically intensive farms, like the kind they have in America, and then small-scale, near-subsistence farms, like Gabby's. Garcia says the goal is to improve the credit system so that you get a new kind of farm, one that's somewhere in the middle. For NPR News, I'm Alex Blumberg.
Every president, Democratic and Republican, since Richard Nixon has vowed to strive to make the United States energy independent. 40 years later, human beings have landed on the moon, human hearts are routinely transplanted, communism has collapsed, and silicon chips have made it possible to pack a library worth of information into a device smaller than your thumb. So why hasn't the United States, or any nation, become energy independent? Jim Woolsey is the chairman of Woolsey Partners and a former director of Central Intelligence. He specializes in a range of alternative energy and security issues. He joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
So what are some of the obstructions, technological, economic, and political?
Well, in part, we haven't been working frequently on the right problem. There are two energy systems, essentially, in the U.S. One is transportation, and that's about 70% oil. And the other is the electricity grid, and that's over half fueled by coal and then natural gas, nuclear, hydro, and others. They don't have very much to do with one another now. Back in the 70s, it was different. Oil-fired power plants provided about 20% of the country's electricity. So if you were building a nuclear power plant or a wind farm in the 70s, you could well be replacing oil directly. Mm-hmm. Today, you're not.
So when people talk about generating alternative sources of energy, and it often is things like wind or solar, that's not necessarily addressing the problem of foreign oil dependence.
It's not really addressing the problem of foreign oil dependence. No, that doesn't have much to do with it and won't for many years.
So where does that leave us?
In a way, there's been too much emphasis on the foreign side of this. Yes, we import well over half our oil now, and that's a bad thing. And we borrow $1 billion a day, essentially, to import oil. But producing the oil domestically helps solve the balance of payments problem, but that's about all it does. Mm-hmm. It will not interfere with OPEC's domination of oil. Something close to 80% of the world's proven reserves of oil are in OPEC states. And they are the low-cost producers, and they have the big reserves. So they're going to be effectively running the international oil trade and running the cartel that runs it, even if we drill more domestically. And so they're going to run the system. We have to effectively destroy oil as a strategic commodity. Not destroy oil, but destroy its strategic role, its dominance of transportation.
Well, that's why we've asked you here. It sounds attractive. How do you do it?
Well, I think you want to focus on existing infrastructure and existing vehicles, and there are several things that could be done relatively quickly. One, and the administration is doing this, I think, and various people on the Hill, encouraging moving toward electrification, particularly, I think, plug-in hybrids. Another is improving the efficiency of internal combustion engines. There are a number of startup companies that are inventing computer chips and valves and all kinds of things that you can use to modify existing engines in existing vehicles to get something like a 20-30% improvement in fuel efficiency. You can also encourage the use of biofuels generally. Require the automobile manufacturers much more rapidly than we're now requiring them to move to what's called an open standard flexible fuel vehicles. It just requires them to change the kind of plastic in the fuel line of the car and a bit of software, $40, $50 a vehicle in the manufacturing process. And that, I think, would be an extremely positive step. One reason it would be positive is that we've got a serious health risk problem from using petroleum products. The fine particulates that are carried into the atmosphere by what's called the aromatics, benzene, toluene, xylene, which is what the oil companies now use to increase octane, are highly carcinogenic. It really looks as if tens of thousands of deaths from malignancy a year and hundreds of millions of dollars in added health care costs are caused by these fine particulates, which the oil companies have a special waiver on, essentially. If you run a chemical plant, you can't put benzene, toluene, xylene into the atmosphere, but they are permitted to do it because it's from a mobile source like gasoline in a car.
People often point out you can burn oil. It's portable. That's why it's good for cars. There's a reason why people use oil.
Well, it does carry a lot of energy in a relatively small space. But at least as far as I'm concerned, that's about where its advantages stop. And there are just a number of things that are in the works that are going to give oil a real run for its money. Some of them are going to need some initial help. But I think the government role could largely be one of a Teddy Roosevelt-style trust buster, going after oil's cartel and oil's dominance of transportation to break it. Same thing happened to salt in the very early 20th century. Salt was a strategic commodity for thousands of years. It was the only way to preserve meat. Countries went to war over salt mines. At the beginning of the 20th century, the coming of the electric grids meant that all of a sudden refrigeration and freezing was available affordably, and salt's dominance just fell apart within a relatively few years. That's what we need to do to oil. We need to make it as boring as salt is today.
Thank you, Mr. Woolsey.
Thank you.
Jim Woolsey, Chairman of Woolsey Partners and former Director of the CIA.